Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up.
Work stress will make you sick at the same training load that you would have been fine with without the work stress. In the period after a marathon, you are in an inflammatory state. Those who are the least fit are four times more likely to end up in hospital with COVID than those in the fittest group.
Well, it's just on a year since the arrival of this incredible stage of the world history has hit us in terms of COVID and pandemics. And I think it was probably March or February, March last year when we did one of our first podcasts on the COVID pandemic. And obviously in that time, as you can imagine, it might have been a miserable time for the rest of the world and for most of the world. But I think for research scientists, I'd imagine it was probably a time when they were looking forward to doing many different experiments and research projects and all sorts of things. And one of the things we're going to be looking at today is a little bit about some of the research that's been done around COVID, and with a specific reference to, obviously, our sporting people, whether they are professional or non-professionals. And also the wider effects of immunity on the body and how the body responds, whether you're fit or not fit, and whether you are less likely to get a more serious case of COVID or least likely to get a more serious case of COVID. So as usual, I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. And Ross, I mean, you said you had a stat, but there were literally thousands of COVID studies done since COVID hit a year and a bit ago.
Oh, you're two orders of magnitude low there. I remember seeing a tweet and it was literally in the mid 100,000 range. Sure. Even in the first couple of months, I remember the number of studies that were going into preprint, which is like an academic thing that's growing, where you've submitted your paper for review to go to a scientific journal, but then you can publish it before it's been published, effectively, which causes a lot of issues because the whole peer review process is meant to provide some sort of quality control and rigor, and people were seeing all these preprints, and I reckon a lot of them ended up either massively changed or outright rejected. But it's probably getting up to close to a million now, and most of them are probably nonsense, rubbish studies. But the good ones, there are thousands and thousands and tens, hundreds of thousands of them. And so I don't think, I mean, we said this when we did that podcast last year, I don't think the world has ever learned so much about one thing so quickly. And badly in some instances, but here we are, more knowledgeable than we were, but still not perfectly knowledgeable.
Just as an aside, I mean, you obviously look at studies yourself a lot and in your work. When people say things like peer review, all that sort of thing, when can you look at a study and say that has got gravitas and we can take it seriously?
In theory, you should always read the study and then apply logic and sound background context knowledge to it, because sometimes a study published in a really top quality journal is still nonsense.
How does that happen though? Surely a quality journal like I follow the British Medical Journal, they obviously have editors in there making sure that whatever they publish is done well.
Well, a couple of things. Sometimes the data is not robust, and there've been cases where papers have been retracted because they have recognized after the fact that there's something wrong in the data. Sometimes it's fraudulent, other times it's just accidental. But I think the main thing driving it, especially in COVID, is that you must understand that these journals are not there purely for the sake of knowledge. They're still businesses. And so there is a degree of competition between them for readership. They're competing for share of eyeballs and thus wallet. And so an editor who can publish an attractive study on a controversial topic, one that maybe goes a little bit against the grain and will start a conversation and will be newsworthy and media worthy, is more inclined to accept a paper with errors and limitations in it. So that's not, look, there's no perfect study. So anything, whether it's in my field or in oncology, whatever, will always have limitations because you can never do something absolutely perfectly. But as long as those are disclosed. And the problem with the COVID stuff is that the study designs were often rushed and imperfect. Those limitations weren't always disclosed. But because people were fighting so hard to be heard among the noise, they were willing to maybe sidestep or look past some of those issues. Mm. And so that's the problem. I mean, it's human nature will affect everything, not just, the world of peer review is not immune to human nature. And then the other thing is mates publish for mates. Mm. So when I submit a paper, you have an opportunity to suggest reviewers. Mm. Like no one suggests a reviewer who they know is going to be antagonistic.
No.
And then if you're tight and friendly with the editor, then you also have a little bit more favor and so on. So it's not a perfect, it's a good system.
It's not ideal when people's lives and some of the government, I suppose government also look at these sort of research studies and they make decisions based on the latest research. Because as we always say in this podcast, we like to believe that everything that we say in this podcast is based on good, scientific, robust research.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to sit here and go all scorched earth now on the world of published research because it is a good system. It's just not a perfect system.
Yeah.
Because the people are conflicted, not necessarily maliciously, but because that's what humans are.
Yeah.
And so you'll get even these organizations that have been set up to advise governments on COVID response and lockdown. When should it be released? How should vaccines be done? They are subject to similar conflicts like any other business. Exactly. They shouldn't be in the business of profit. That would be unethical. But there are still conflicts. So it's why people have to be discerning and a little bit always skeptical, but just understand, like, you have to get your data from only credible sources and then verify.
So before we get into the nuts and bolts of our discussion today, we also have a little bit of a shout out to some of our new Patreon supporters who over the last week we've had quite a few additional supporters, and a couple of them are quite close to me, Ross, from what you have picked up on our Patreon page.
Indeed, yes. A few family members of one of the hosts. None of my family are patrons. I need to have a word.
I'm leading that.
You are.
That competition.
Yeah, so as you know, Patreon is where you can go on and pledge a little bit of monthly amount to our cause. We don't charge, obviously, for the podcast, and everything we produce is available to all. That might change in future. You never know. But these are the folks who, out of gratitude, I guess, have donated. So I just wanted to run through them very quickly. We have three levels. They are Olympic athlete. And in that group, we have six Olympic athletes to welcome. Nikki, no surname given. Welcome, Nikki. Thanks for your pledge. Paul Brady, Anders Norregard, Simon Finch. That's the first of the two. Marcus Blaurock, and then Nicholas Finch. That completes the triumvirate of Finch brothers.
There we go.
You need to have a word with Wade. Wade is Mike's son. He cycles like a demon. He's a hell of a good cyclist, and he has not yet joined the Finch clan on Patreon. Then Olympic champion, also six there. So this is a slightly higher monthly donation. So thanks hugely to these people: Mike Hewison, Paul Whitney, Patrick Doyle, Ian Robbo, who I've known for years on Twitter and is now part of the Patreon family. Thanks, Ian. Shane Malone, and then Dean Shears. Thanks to all of you. You are Olympic champions. And then the last of those is Stephen Keenan, who is an Olympic legend and then some, because he went in way above even the minimum requirement for an Olympic legend. So he joins the pantheon of Olympic gods on Mount Zeus. So thanks very much to him. I mean, it's just hugely flattering. We do this, we squeeze it in amongst work. That's why we're sometimes quite sporadic. We apologize. But when we get these donations and pledges, it really is, it's just a very humbling and flattering thing to receive. So thanks very much to all of you.
Yeah, indeed. Just to give you some background, I mean, I know I'm sort of sharing some family secrets here today, but both my brothers, when we grew up, I always felt that I was the closest I was going to get to elite sport was going to be as a journalist. So I spent most of my life writing about it, and as we can see on this podcast, talking about it. But both my brothers are very competent writers, and just on a couple of weeks ago, my brother who lives in Australia, did a sub 75 minute 21K at the age of, what's he now, 47?
That's Simon, eh?
Yeah, Simon. So very, very good runner. And he's often the subject of many discussions around some of the technical aspects of running. And I know that Ross and I are going to chat about some of these things you're talking about. Like, he's got a system now where they can measure power in running. And a lot of his stuff in Strava now is measured in power on running. And then Nicholas is somebody who loves the seriously long distances in cycling. And I'm not talking about the sort of 200 kilometer, 160, 100 miler sort of distances. He's done things like the Nordkarp, which is, you know, 300 kilometers a day for 15 days. And on the weekend, he just threw out a quick 200K ride on his own in England. So I'm definitely the sort of the, I wouldn't say I'm the black sheep, but I'm certainly not at any level athletically than my brothers are. I'm more of a talker than a doer.
Nicholas could listen to every podcast we've ever made in one ride. And then the thing for Simon, and this is also for other listeners, is here's the science of sport challenges. He has to break his mass in a half marathon.
Yeah.
So that's the running equivalent of shooting your age in golf, is run under your weight in a half marathon in kilograms. Pounds is cheating. So for him, he must be 72.
He's 72 kilos. Yeah.
So he's got to knock 3 minutes off that, or he's got to hold a 75 as a heavier guy. Go for it, Simon.
So the interesting one was we actually discussed this the other day. When you told me that was a good challenge for him, he was sort of saying, well, that's possible for somebody like me. But when you consider some of the elite male athletes who probably sit around the sort of 56, 57.
Yeah, exactly.
That's properly good. And for the female in particular, that's often quite tricky because the female athletes are almost impossible.
No, not happening.
For them to break 1 hour.
It's a male thing. If you can do that. And so if you're listening and you've done that, let us know.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious.
Fascinating.
I've got a mate who's a 90-kilogram guy, and he runs every year. He's run a sub-90 for like 15 years in a row, and he's going to see how long he can keep it going.
Incredible.
So it does, because most of the elites are close. The elite men are close to their mass, the Kenyan guys and so on. But not even there, I would say fewer than half of them are doing it. But you can go and do it. Do it, Simon. And listeners, let us know if you have.
It's a good challenge.
Yeah.
Right, so let's get into the nuts and bolts of what we're going to be discussing today. And let's start off with some of the studies that Ross has been looking at over the last couple of weeks, talking specifically about whether COVID and the long-term effects on COVID have had on sporting groups. Not necessarily professional, but most of those studies have happened amongst serious athletes, haven't they?
Yes, because in order to track an athlete or a person, they tend to be part of a system that also requires testing and then medical intervention and longitudinal tracking. So naturally, that's going to happen in athletes. But of course, we mentioned in the introduction, when there are so many studies and so many questions about COVID, there are now numerous studies around the world tracking people who have had COVID in different degrees. So mildly symptomatic versus severe versus hospitalized. And in the future, we will have a better understanding of what this long COVID, have you heard this term, long COVID? Why it happens. Even at the start of this whole pandemic, people were bringing up this idea that we knew that influenza affected some people for a long time. I mean, I'm sure you know people who've had the flu and they just cannot recover from it months afterwards. They're still fatigued and lacking energy and so on.
Often when they train through early flu, don't they?
Yeah, and so we'll get into that because this was one of the key concerns about the return to sport is when an athlete has had COVID, what is the risk to that athlete when they start training again? Because there are literally fatal complications that can occur. That risk is real. And so the decision makers had to try and assess that. And the evidence for that took a while coming because these things are, I hope all the listeners appreciate that when you start studying this stuff, it's not easy. It's very difficult. And they have now started publishing that. And so in the last couple of months, there are two big studies that have come out of the USA. One of them is on professional athletes in their leagues. So now we're talking NFL, baseball, soccer, women's NBA and men's NBA and ice hockey. So those 789 athletes, I think, were tracked. I forget exactly the numbers. 330-odd had a SARS COVID test positive.
Sure.
And
it's
they
almost half.
Yeah, about that.
Sure.
But look, that's not the whole cohort of athletes available. So it's a convenient sample. So it wouldn't be surprising that you'd have more. And what they then did is cardiac screening. So they did the full workup, the ECGs, the cardiac MRIs, the troponins and so on. And you see, the thing they were looking for is there evidence weeks after COVID has cleared that these people still have some cardiac complications? And the main one is myocarditis. That's really the scary one that is known to exist as a consequence of viral infection.
Which is, quite simply?
So myo, muscle, cardio, heart, and itis, inflammation. So it is literally an inflammatory disease of the heart muscle. And so what happens there is that the viral affects the heart muscle or the pericardium, which is, you get pericarditis as well, also around the heart. And what's happening in that instance is that you then get muscle damage initially, necrosis, which is the death of the muscle, inflammation occurs as a result, so you get edema and fluid around. That's how they identify it using this cardiac MRI method. And the problem with myocarditis is that it has been linked to sudden death in athletics, in athletes. Mm. So that is, and in fact, the data that I've seen suggests that about 9-10%, so it's every 10th case of sudden death, can be linked or associated with a myocarditis. That's why, and you publish these magazines, I guarantee you dozens of times you've told people, do not exercise when you are infected with a virus.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing you're trying to avoid is that. I mean, I remember when I was 15, just having started running, a guy that we trained with in his early 30s collapsed and died in a 8K time trial that we did. It was February that year. And he said to me he was feeling a little bit poorly, and we finished the 8K. He sat down on the sidewalk. We went off to do some stretches with my school sort of team athletes.
Sure.
The time we came back, he'd lost consciousness and he died. And it was later reported that he'd had the flu and that he decided he'd try and run it off. And that's the catastrophic outcome of it. So this is not, it might be a small risk, but if it happens, it's life-ending.
And I mean, if you talk about, I mean, obviously we're talking specifically about COVID, but we are talking generally about immunity and the effects of disease on and viruses on the body. When professional athletes get the flu, is there a protocol that they go through to say, okay, I mean, with a professional athlete saying, okay, I've got the chills, they just don't train? Or is there always that sort of desire? The reason why I ask this is that I've seen on a couple of occasions people, where they talk about an athlete being sick during the Tour de France, for instance, and they kind of get through that first week and they seem to come out the other end.
Mm.
But essentially, in that situation, if you have a virus, you are literally playing with your life.
Yeah. And I mean, I couldn't tell you what that risk is, because you can imagine how difficult it is to study. You'd have to gather thousands of people with viral infections and then track them during exercise, which if you did that deliberately would be highly unethical. Mm. And to do it incidentally is very complicated. So I couldn't put a risk to this. Probably someone in the world can. And maybe in future we should do a more detailed exploration of sudden death, and then we can explore in athletes and explore this. But yes, that risk is definitely non-zero.
Mm.
And in the absence of incentives to exercise, why would you take it? What those guys are doing is pushing on, because they've decided, rightly or wrongly, that the costs or the risks are
pressures.
The risks don't outweigh the benefits because of those pressures.
Mm.
But yeah, that's the problem. So in answer to your question, is there a protocol? It depends what sport and where you play it. Because in US professional sports, cardiac screening is done. So an athlete, and it's very influenced by symptoms. So a viral infection that produces the symptoms that we've all become too familiar with, the shivering, the chills, the fever, the aching muscles and joints, that sort of stuff, and then plus the now we know the cough and all that with COVID, that is an indication for cardiac screening on return to play. That cardiac screening can take various forms, but generally an ECG, they measure something called troponin, which is a protein that exists in heart muscle in a certain form. And if that's in the blood, it indicates damage to the heart muscle. It wouldn't be in your blood otherwise.
Yeah.
And then if those signs are abnormal, then they send you for cardiac MRIs. And I was listening to a podcast on this as part of the stuff for rugby, because we're thinking about what do we do about COVID players who want to return. And they then do this cardiac MRI, and that's where you identify the myocarditis and the pericarditis. Imperfectly, there are false positives. Sometimes an athlete's heart looks like a sick heart when it's actually very healthy. So it gets quite tricky to distinguish between a positive MRI finding caused by disease as opposed to cardiac remodeling, basically. Sure. Okay. So that's
Swimmer's heart, is it?
Well, just general, large athletes' hearts. Well, so that's an example of a false positive in another area of cardiac screening. But the same thing is true for this myocarditis using cardiac MRI. So anyway, the fear is, backtrack. When they find it, I believe, I heard this on that podcast, that there was a somewhat arbitrary but 3-month stand-down period imposed on athletes, during which time they had to recover from that myocarditis because the risk is, as I say, too high for them to justify. Mm-hmm. Not a fixed 3 months, mind, but that was the recommendation. And incidentally, the studies that came out, and there are two of them. The latest one is by Bagish and a whole group of collaborators. I think the first one's Martinez et al. We'll give you the links in the show notes. They found very low percentage of athletes with these myocarditis, so that's good.
Yeah,
I think it was 0.6 in the professional athlete study and 0.5% in the college athletes. So we're talking 6 or 5 in 1,000.
Because the reason why that's interesting is that, and I'm just going on my perception of some of the stuff I've read, is that initially there was a lot of concern about the long-term effects of COVID on professional athletes. And
right.
I think there were a couple of studies that came out that suggested that athletes were, that there was going to be medium to long-term issues there. Did you see those studies?
Yeah.
How did they look? It wasn't looking good for pro-athletes that had COVID.
Yeah, I think it was in August, September last year was the first one. Came out of Germany, if I remember correctly. And they'd put 100 people who'd been quite sick with COVID. So that's the first key point is these were older people. I think mean age was 59 or early 60s, somewhere around there. And they'd been quite ill. So these were sick patients who'd been quite severely affected by COVID. And 78% of them had these signs of cardiac abnormalities after recovery from COVID. And that was the headline grabber. Mm. That was an example of, I'm not going to call it a bad study, but it was a widely debated, criticized study because of its design. You know, you're taking a fairly biased sample, and then the media, and this is not even on the scientists, the media says cardiac damage and COVID. Now, all of a sudden, everyone thinks that that applies to every one of the 30 million in America. Right. Well, no, it applies to potentially the very ill people who have it. And then there's still issues around who diagnoses it, what's the threshold, because it's not a black or white diagnosis. There's a degree of subjectivity. There's criteria that have been agreed upon by experts about when is it a positive, when is it potential, when is it definite, you know. So none of this stuff is as definitive as we'd like it to be, I think, is the answer. Subsequently, there was a study out of Ohio State University where they took 26 young athletes and they found 4 cases of positive or abnormal MRIs in the heart, cardiac MRIs. So that was kind of then a follow-up saying, hang on, these are young guys. These are athletic 20-odd-year-olds in the university environment, and 4 out of 26, that's almost a quarter, are showing the same signs. This is a problem. So that was why this big study was eventually done and is so important, is because it's now shown that the prevalence is considerably lower than was initially thought. That's the good news. It's not non-zero, but we now have a set of guidelines that says that if you've had COVID and you were symptomatic, this should be done, ABC. If you were asymptomatic, you need to do less because the symptoms turns out to be none of the – in the 789, for instance, there were 5 cases of abnormal cardiac MRIs. None of them were asymptomatic. So only symptomatic people have that.
Right.
So so what was initially a very foggy, distorted picture is becoming clearer, and hopefully within another year it'll be clear enough that we can definitively – answer it. But
so in other words, what we're saying is that if you're an athlete that's potentially contracted COVID, you're not symptomatic, then you get the next level that are symptomatic, and then you've got the next level of people that potentially have long-term effects from that.
Correct.
Symptomatic. So in other words, the chances of having long-term effects as an athlete or somebody who's fit of things like myocarditis are obviously relatively small.
Yeah, we're talking 5, 6 in 1,000.
Yeah.
And it can be identified with, look, they're not easy test to do. And a stress ECG is not something you can just get at a pharmacy, but it's certainly easier than a cardiac MRI. So the positive contribution made by these papers, for instance, is that there's now a sequence, a well-understood sequence. It's not that different to what's always existed. There's a triad of basic tests, and if any of those are abnormal, then they're saying, now you go for the cardiac MRI. So if there are listeners who are concerned about this, then those stress ECG type tests that you can have done at a medical practice, where obviously they do them, would be your first port of call. But your risks are, and this was maybe the interesting thing, is that the latest paper, Bagish et al. Concluded that the risks of this myocarditis in that population is about the same as the risk of myocarditis with the flu influenza that we've seen for the 5 years before. So it appears that in the young athletic population, COVID does not create a new risk. It's just the same as baseline. So that's reassuring. Now, I know there's people maybe listen to this, the COVID denialists, and they're going to use this to weaponize the fact, oh, COVID is just the flu. It's not. Mm-hmm. But in this specific instance, the evidence that it seems to exist from this paper shows that COVID doesn't actually increase the risk of myocarditis beyond what the normal flu did.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So interesting, just a quick digression here. Myocarditis, once you have it, are you able to recover from it? Yeah, is it a permanent condition?
No, you recover. So that's the same as any infection, inflammatory response. The body just needs the time to deal with. And of course, what you don't want to do is impose an additional stress on a heart where the heart muscle is already affected. And you know, in the early stages of myocarditis, you're getting literally the myocytes are being damaged, and then there's necrosis in the fluid. And what that leads to then eventually can be these arrhythmias. That's when they become fatal. You know, the normal rhythm of the heart, the electrical rhythms of the heart get messed up. And but if that goes away over time.
If you train when you've potentially got this inflammation of the heart, what you're saying is there is potential long-term damage or permanent damage as a result of that. Do we know that?
I don't know. I don't know whether you see the big risk if you train with this damage to the heart is sudden death.
Yeah.
So anything long term is irrelevant.
It's quite a big risk.
Yeah. This long term is no longer on the table. I don't know whether there's a dose response almost where instead of going all or nothing, you could have a 5 out of 10 and then you've caused some. I suspect not, but I'm not a look. I don't want to. The world is too full of people.
We'll have to get a cardiologist one day on this.
You know, we try to get John Dresner is the guy, and he's now the editor of the British Journal of Sports Medicine. And last year, when the US college sport was about to restart, we tried to get him on to talk about sudden death generally, and he was keen. And then I think I can't imagine how busy they must have been trying to get that sport going.
100,000 studies.
So anyway, John Dresner was lined up, and then COVID claimed him from our lineup, but we'll do it again.
Because the reason why I asked that question is that obviously for all of us that train, and you know, there are many amateur cyclists, runners, people enduring during any kind of sport who sometimes when we think we've got a little bit of a cold might have some signs of the flu. Mm. We might do some damage to our hearts. And I've always wondered whether that damage is permanent and are we able to, you know, get our hearts back to where they used to be. Like when smokers give up smoking, do eventually their lungs become normal again after a couple of years? Does the same thing happen with the hearts? And I guess it's a good question we should ask him.
It is. And I mean, I don't want to, you know, the world is too full of people who pretend to be experts in things they're not. But I suspect that you don't incur damage that is absolutely irreversible. But you still wouldn't want to take that risk. That's why in your magazine, I bet you've done the neck check article piece, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if it's below the neck, don't do it.
Yeah, by which you mean fever, chills, aching muscles, because that's an indication of a systemic infection. That's viral. If you have something where there's a cough and a sinus type infection and headaches, then the rule of thumb is that it's a little bit safer. And I suspect that in many of the cyclists who get that bronchitis type infection, they would say that they can go because they know that it's localized. Whereas when it's a systemic infection, then that's when you start to take that risk of, now that systemic infection is going to hit the heart and suddenly you become a statistic. So my advice always is, what have you got to gain if you're a recreational athlete? Even if you're a serious recreational athlete, what is there to gain from going on and doing 2 hours with a viral infection? Like, what are you trying to prove? I guess there's a lot to lose.
Yeah, the thing is that it is very difficult when you are somebody that relies on exercise beyond just the exercise portion of that. For many people who, like you and I, who rely on exercise to some extent for stress and reducing stress, it's become part of our lives. The guys are riding on a Sunday morning. You think, well, I'm not feeling too bad. Maybe I'll just go and give it a whirl. You know, there's always that temptation to do it. And I think we've often said in this podcast, you know, be smart about how you train and not just on a level of being sick or not, but just being smart about how your body feels a lot of the time is key.
But it's like everything in life. It's just trade-offs, you know. You could go and do it and maybe you make it, but you make your situation worse. And so what would have been 3 days off to recover becomes 10 days off to recover because of one ride. So anyway, logically, I know it's hard. I do it. We all do it.
We all do it, yeah.
But logically, you should just actually say 2 or 3 days and then I'll start up again.
I remember a couple of episodes ago, you mentioned how the body responds and to exercise. And I know that this is an area of speciality where we probably need to get somebody in that talks specifically about this. But We know that exercise helps build a strong immune system.
Oh, yes. That's unequivocally known. There's no doubt that fitness equates to immune performance. Mm-hmm. And it's been shown in numerous studies, I think, that healthier, fitter people are less likely to be affected by pathogens and stress. And I mean, infection is a stressor. So if fitness can be viewed as an integrated system where the body is just able to deal with stress, then it stands to reason that fitness will make us better able to deal with illness. And so it's been shown that in athletically trained individuals, the risk of infection is lower. And there's what's called a, because it's always a little bit more complex than just that, so let me build it up. There's what's called a J curve. So if a sedentary, inactive, healthy person has a risk of, say, 1, a moderately trained or well-trained person has a risk of 0.5. So in other words, they're half as likely to get sick.
Wow.
Right?
It's not just small
between percentages. So the studies, that there's a guy called David Neiman, who's the pioneer of this exercise and immune function. That's his. He's got a graph in one of his papers showing this. You see, where it gets tricky is that as you then go beyond reasonable or manageable exercise towards high training loads, that risk then tilts back up. So that's why it's called the J curve.
So you become immune compromised the harder you train.
Yeah, and that risk can be 5 or 6 times higher. So a highly trained athlete, high volumes and high intensities, is more likely to suffer infection than someone who's moderately trained. So that's where, and I think...
And how do you define that? How do you define moderate versus high intensity? That's always the question, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's moderated, remember, by so many factors. So the training load that I can handle, say, right now, might have caused an illness 6 months ago because my diet was different then compared to now, or vice versa. I'm not getting enough sleep because I've got a toddler or whatever it is, maybe. Then the training load that I would have been able to handle is now suddenly too much because the sleep has compromised immune function. So work stress will make you sick at the same training load that you would have been fine with without the work stress. So you have to, I think, have a holistic approach and view. But the rule of thumb generally is that there is this, or I think the agreed upon concept is that there is a J-shaped curve, and that people who do more training and high intensity training are more likely to be infected than people who do moderate. So it introduces us again to what I've used before. It's a Goldilocks zone, you know?
Yeah.
This applies to more than just the temperature of your porridge. It also applies to the volume of your training. So not too little and not too much, just right. But you've asked the key question. Just right is highly variable from one person to the next, and even within one person.
Because I think, I mean, we did touch on this very early on when we did our first podcast around COVID, where, in fact, I asked you what's sort of the protocol for many athletes out there. And they, of course, they're, you know, very top-end athletes. They wouldn't have been able to necessarily do events, so they would probably take a few steps back in terms of their training during the lockdown period. Mm-hmm. And the same applied for amateur athletes. And I think there is that sense, for if you know your body and you're reasonably regular exerciser, that you know when you're pushing it a bit, as you mentioned, when you understand that there's stresses around work and sleep and lifestyle, that sort of thing, that you kind of know instinctively when you're pushing it a bit. I know, for instance, when I get a little bit of a sore throat, that maybe I'm pushing a little bit. And I think it's one of those things where it is very individual.
Yeah, it's highly unscientific. But if you say, how are you feeling? If the guy says, I feel a bit run down.
Yeah.
That is a symptom or a sign, whatever you want to call it, a feeling that is a precursor to, I'm going to get sick soon.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly like walking that tightrope when you're training. And this is true for everyone. Elite athletes are doing it even more intensively. Well, let's say that a tightrope is further above the ground, but it's the same issue for them. It's the same for any person. So that's why self-awareness, training diaries, monitoring sleep and recovery start to become quite influential. And then we've all seen now the practices that we know will reduce infection. So athletes in high training blocks do avoid closed rooms, tight confined spaces with lots of people, hand washing is known in Olympic teams to reduce the risk of infection at the Olympic Games. So, and I remember when I did a little bit of work with Arsenal Football Club, every door handle had a hand sanitizer on it. And this was pre-COVID.
Sure.
So when you open a door, you basically spritzed your hands with hand sanitizer, because it's known that if you do that stuff, you're not likely to get, and that's not COVID prevention, right?
Yeah.
This is E. coli. This is bacteria, parvovirus, all of them. So, yeah, that's where you start taking precautions.
It's interesting. I mean, you touched on, obviously, a little bit about the Olympics is coming up in a couple of months' time from now. And
maybe.
With the infection rate going up in Tokyo, obviously, there are some questions about that. But there are obviously a lot of questions about what the protocols will be. And I didn't know that, as you said, with Arsenal, that at that level of sport, that even before pre-COVID times, there was all these precautions. Because I guess what you're saying is, at that level of sport, those athletes are slightly immune compromised often.
Oh, sure. And it's not unique. That's not just Arsenal. They weren't doing something innovative.
Yeah.
I remember reading Norwegian Olympic policy was every athlete was given 2 or 3 bottles of hand sanitizer a week.
Mm.
And they had to carry it around on themselves, because that's what it took. Those cross-country skiers, you can imagine the airway challenge. Because this is the other thing, by the way. Endurance athletes get what look like upper respiratory tract infections, which aren't actually infections, just because of the huge volume of air they're breathing in and out. So they might be vulnerable then to an infection because of that inflammatory response.
Yeah.
So you have to protect them with other precautions. Is basically the point.
What's the open window hypothesis?
So
this relates to overtraining, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's an acute training bout thing. It's somewhat contended in the academic world. But the idea is that when you do exercise, there is a period after that session during which your susceptibility to infection goes up. So in other words, the window is open. Now, that is way back in the 1990s, for instance, it was shown that runners who competed in the Los Angeles Marathon were more likely to report infections the week after than those who didn't.
Yes.
Two Oceans Marathon, which is a local one in Cape Town, same study. I think the Los Angeles one, the runners were about 4 or 5 times more likely to have an infection than the non-runner. Here in Two Oceans, it was about twice as likely.
And this is the week after the event.
So this is
in
the week.
Their body threw under a lot of stress.
You race the Saturday, and for the next week or two, did you get sick? And turns out you're twice as likely to say yes to that question than if you didn't sat on the couch that Saturday. Similarly, marathon runners in preparation, there is a response, a dose response, such that those who are doing 90K a week or more are more likely to get sick than those doing 70 to 90, those doing 50 to 70. So these things all contribute to this idea that more training exposes you to risk. And it's been suggested that that risk happens soon after training because very briefly, the immune system has these two parts. We've all, I think, learned about antibodies because of vaccines and COVID, which induces them. That's kind of like the adaptive part of our immune system, the one that has memory. So our body sees a pathogen, COVID or whatever it is, and then builds the antibodies to it so that next time we see it, we can instantly neutralize. We also have an innate immune system, which is more like the white blood cells and mediated by the inflammatory response, which we've all heard about. Both of those systems are compromised by high intensity, high volume exercise. So they've measured, for instance, the white blood cells, the antibody responses, the inflammatory response, the cytokines after a marathon compared to a...
What are cytokines quickly?
So cytokines are cellular mediators of inflammation. You would have... Okay. Many listeners would have heard about the so-called cytokine storm. The people who had the worst response to COVID were the ones who wound up having the cytokine storm. So the inflammatory response in these individuals was just absolutely
enormous. So they're a marker for inflammation.
Correct, yeah. Right. So what happens is when you run a marathon, your neutrophil, which is an inflammatory cell on the white blood cell side, your antibodies are all suppressed and your cortisol and your inflammatory markers are all increased. So in the period after a marathon, you are in a inflammatory state, not ideal, because the theory is that that suppresses the body's ability to mount an immune response to a subsequent infection. So now I'm in this sort of inflammatory state. My cortisol is up. That's an anti-inflammatory, trying to correct all this. I now encounter a flu bug. Mm-hmm. I just cannot deal with that on top of everything else. Whereas when you do moderate intensity exercise, the opposite happens. Inflammation goes down, antibodies and neutrophil activity and natural killer cell activity go up. So now I'm primed to actually deal with infection. Mm-hmm. So they talk about, for instance, the exchange of these immune cells from lymph nodes to circulation is increased by exercise, which makes sense.
Yeah.
And so this is called immunosurveillance, which is increased by exercise.
Sure.
So if you think about your immune system like your neighborhood police.
So little white cells are cruising around with their guns cocked looking for, because they get around more when they're exercising.
They're slowly rotating blue lights trying to just put off anyone. Yeah,
I like the image of that.
That's basically what it is. It's your neighborhood security watch or police, whatever it is, and they're patrolling more often after exercise because there is just activation, increased exchange of these immune cells between the tissues. And so now if we encounter a pathogen, we're going to hit it quicker and we're going to neutralize it, because we also have, this is the other thing exercise training does, is it amplifies the capacity for an antigen response, the antibody response to be mounted. Well-trained individuals have better vaccine responses than untrained, unhealthy, unfit people, for instance.
Yeah.
So the long and short of it is that exercise training helps, but it is thought that there might be a period after high intensity or high volume training where you are more vulnerable. That's contended. So for instance, you know, I said to you about Los Angeles Marathon, 5 times more likely, 2 oceans twice as likely if you ran it to get sick.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that religious gatherings are precipitators of infection. Now, we all know why, because they are confined spaces with a lot of people in a small, often unventilated spot.
But there's different mechanics in terms of how a virus might attack the body there, isn't there? Why would that be an excuse or an idea that research around exercise is not accurate?
Well, because so this is what those who argue against open window are saying, is that when you put 30,000 people on the streets of a marathon like in Los Angeles, that creates the same proximity social what's the opposite of social distancing?
Yeah.
Issues that are
pilgrimage, distancing.
Well, social non-distancing, social closening. So what they're saying is that the exercise event precipitates the infection, not the exercise itself. Okay. Does that make sense? Right. That's what I was getting at. Okay. That somewhat
seems like a stretch to me as a non-scientist, but
because
it makes sense that the body's compromised post a serious bout of exercise. Surely
If I was ruling on this, and there is incidentally, if you want to read on this, I'll also give this, I'll give you this link for the show notes. There is a debate, a written debate in a journal where two different groups debate the yes, no around the open window hypothesis. In other words, does it or does it not exist? And you can make a ruling for yourself. If it was me judging this debate, I would rule in favor of the open window hypothesis. But there are people saying that it's not so much the exercise stress, it's the exercise occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, remember, the exercise often involves a flight. I'm going to fly to the race. It involves a couple of nights of compromised sleep. It involves going out afterwards and potentially socializing, which the person might not do. So there are factors that could confound this open window hypothesis, is the point.
Mm.
But it does make sense. And I think on balance, and I'm nobody's idea of an immunologist, but on balance, there seems to be enough evidence directly that immune markers are negatively affected by exercise.
So if we take, and your idea or the suggestion that when you are doing a serious bout of exercise, you are slightly immune compromised, what can you do to offset that? I mean, what sort of things can an athlete do to stop getting sick?
Okay, three things. This might end up being a lot more than three, but let's try three. Number one is that session is part of an overall load management strategy. So if that is a high-intensity three-hour ride on a Saturday, then you don't do the same thing Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. You allow for recovery so that you can return to baseline and cope. So that's number one. It's overall load management.
Training logic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For the same reasons that you wouldn't do it because you'd actually just overtrain. Mm. Just don't do it because of immune function also. In fact, overtraining and immune function are pretty locked together in lockstep, right?
Makes sense.
Diet. So the replacement of energy, because if you are negative energy balance, immune system is compromised. So you don't train hard and cut energy out, because then you amplify that energy deficit and compromise it. And that's why we've spoken on this podcast about REDS. One of the signs of REDS is immune function. Persistent infections is an indication that your energy balance is negative too often for too long.
Yeah.
Sleep, which again is part of the holistic side of things. You have to. That's when you recover. We spoke to Dale Ray, and immune function is massively influenced by sleep. That's when we do our business. Antibodies are made during those cycles. So therefore, you must prioritize it. Don't squeeze it in.
Yep.
And then actually, the fourth one is just practical. Don't expose yourself to risk where you can avoid it. Mm. So I don't need to tell people after 15 months of pandemic how to avoid that risk, but you know what it is.
Yeah.
So I think those are the key things there. But people should be reassured, by the way. I know now it sounds all negative. We're making it out as though when you go and exercise, you're actually increasing your risk. You, on balance and in totality, you are far less likely to be sick as a fit athletic person than you are if you're unfit. So this is...
I suppose the question is, does that apply to COVID?
It does. So it applies to all disease. Because again, the stress adaptation model is universal. So a fit person who is capable of dealing with the stress of exercise is also capable of dealing with the stress of an infection. That's the point. It's superficial. Mm-hmm. You asked me off air, can we go into the mechanisms? I don't know. Mm-hmm. So no is the answer. But it is universally true. And in fact, a really interesting study was done. The Mayo Clinic is a very famous institution in the United States. They test thousands and thousands of people for cardiovascular conditions. And they use exercise very well as part of the treatment and diagnostic mm-hmm. procedures. And they've got thousands of these members of the public, non-athletes, in fact, who have got exercise tests and who subsequently tested positive for COVID. So this is a great data set, and a paper has been published on this. And what they have found is that if you divide these members of the public, average ages in the 50s, into quartiles, so in other words, top 25%, middle 50%, let's call it, or second 25, third 25, and bottom 25 for fitness, The individuals in the lowest quartile, so in other words, those who are the least fit, measured by VO2 max or METs during exercise, are four times more likely to end up in hospital with COVID than those in the fittest group.
Sure.
So your metabolic fitness created by exercise is a very strong predictor of your hospitalization likelihood when you have COVID. That's a massively influential lesson and principle for
people. And that's a study that we can rely on.
Yeah, this is a good study.
Like, given our discussion around studies.
I think it's 1,180 odd COVID patients.
Yeah.
Who were then tracked. They co-vary, because you can appreciate the people who produce in exercise tests the best VO2 maxes, the highest performance, also tend to be healthy in many other ways.
Yeah.
They're not obese, they're not smokers, they don't have heart disease. In this particular study, they co-varied for those things. So they said even with diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, smoking, and so on, even with those things, exercise fitness predicts in a negative way likelihood of going to hospital. So there's a negative relationship. The fitter you are, the less likely you are to have a severe COVID outcome. And that was, I remember reading a stat around 2000 and whenever it was, SARS in Hong Kong, the same thing was found there. Fitness and training was more likely, those who were fit and trained were more likely to stay out of hospitals. So it is, and that's why a year ago it was already clear, fitness is a public health service.
Yeah.
You can do a lot of things, but fitness is in principle like a vaccine. Mm. That's what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate way. I mean, we have, I mean, obviously hopping about this a lot on this podcast because we are talking about sport generally, but it shows you that the effects of this, and there's lots of reasons why people exercise, and a lot of them are to do with weight loss and lifestyle and that sort of thing. But there is that immune response to not only COVID, but many other things that it's almost like it's a positive side effect.
Fitness is health. I mean, that's what it is. Yeah. It's
I massive. Mean, our bodies are designed to move, aren't they?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We've imposed restrictions on that movement because of lifestyle, but that's the bad thing about advancements. So, but wait, there's more. Wow, I sound like an infomercial. remember that exercise is also treating obesity or preventing obesity and diabetes, and people who exercise are less likely to smoke and have high blood pressure. So, if all those things are known now to be comorbidities, hypertension, et cetera, and you can exercise to reduce their degree and prevalence, then exercise is helping in that way also. So in actual fact, there are two things going on. One is a direct effect that this Mayo Clinic study has found, is that when you are in the fitter top 25%, the fittest 25%, you are a quarter as likely to end up in hospital with COVID. And also, if you're exercising, and they didn't show this, but it's true, is when you exercise, you're less likely to have all the other things that will put you in hospital. And by co-varying for it, they've shown that both those things exist at the same time. So it really is. Exercise is medicine, and it's preventative medicine.
So for those of you that are listening to this podcast that don't have a regular exercise regime, I hope that's enough of an incentive to get yourselves out on the road or on a bike or any kind of exercise that just gives you a little bit of health benefit, because there's more than just, you know, just losing weight and getting some time away from the stress that we have in our daily lives. But yeah, fascinating. Just one quick thing. We touched on this a little bit before we started our podcast today. One of the interesting studies was the effects of close proximity sport on COVID infections. I know it's slightly, we're digressing slightly from the subject, but what was the results of those studies?
Yeah, so also quite positive. All the listeners will recall that when sport was stopped, it had to be, because the prevalence in the community of COVID was so high that the gathering of people for sport, even if it was just the players, was likely to just accelerate the spread. So in order to flatten the curve, which was the buzzword, we had to try and keep people apart, even on sports fields. What subsequently emerged, and I think this was quite predictable, I mean, we said it a few times on this podcast, is that when young, healthy individuals are outdoors, the risk of transmission of the virus is going to be exceptionally low. Really, really low. I remember seeing 1 out of 300 odd outbreaks in China had been traced to an outdoor event. All the others are indoors. So it was very apparent early on that indoor transmission was massively, massively more likely than outdoor transmission. Studies are now starting to come in because of the tracking and tracing and the sport. See, sport actually provides quite a cool, closed, controlled environment to do this in. And there's a study by Ben Jones in rugby league. There's another one in football. But the rugby league one showed, for instance, that they could not identify a transmission caused by playing rugby. They could identify traveling to and from the ground in a car, sharing it with someone with an infection. Social events, clubhouses, visiting homes. But they could not identify, despite the proximity and the fact that you've got these players breathing on each other, tackling each other in very close, intimate contact.
The scrum is quite intimate.
Exactly. So this one, by the way, was rugby league, right?
Yeah,
but
okay.
But this, still, same thing. Is like they are literally in each other's faces. No transmissions confirmed through that, and very low overall because of the policies that were put in place. The same is true in cycling. Remember in the Tour de France, you've got 180 odd people gathered together daily for 3 weeks, basically never apart. They had a couple of cases, but all of them were in mechanics. The race director, remember, had to leave the race because of presumably handshaking with some dignitaries. but no secondary infection to other athletes. And so the picture that's emerging now is that the risk of transmission in sport is exceptionally low. Where sport becomes more dangerous, risky, is as a catalyst for the things that are high risk. So for instance, players sharing change room facilities for too long. So you had to monitor that and make sure that there was no lingering around the change rooms. The public attending games using public transport, that's where sport. Then we, last year in June, we covered this, like when Novak Djokovic organized his tennis tour and they all had nightclub after parties, that was the problem. Not the,
it wasn't the tennis
being played outdoors in a, on a Serbian afternoon. It was the fact that they all went to these nightclubs in the evening and just shouting at each other from 20 centimeters away just to be heard. That's a disaster waiting to happen in terms of, so anyway, the picture is good that sport itself doesn't cause onward transmission. And that's why it's so good that the world is starting now, I think, to return to community sport. I've seen a couple games of social cricket, club cricket matches here in Cape Town. I know in England, in the United Kingdom rather, they are playing community rugby. We've actually just developed a guideline for return to community rugby to help people get back into it without risk of injury. Rugby?
Yeah.
So the wheels are now starting to turn, and I think they're turning safely is the message. And it's the indoor stuff that we still need to be vigilant about, but not the sport.
Well, there we have it. If you are out there and exercising and being active, you are far less likely to get very seriously ill from COVID. Hopefully you don't get it at all. But if you do, you are less likely to suffer any real consequences, just besides a few little exceptional cases. So the message is pretty strong. And for those of you participating in sport, I imagine golf's a pretty safe option as well, unless you go into the clubhouse afterwards, being out there in the open. But if you can avoid the beers in the clubhouse afterwards and just get out there and do the sport you're doing, you're probably most likely to have more benefit than you have with risk.
And then just the one last thing, because I have to punt the vaccine because it's like it is the evidence-based way to go. Doesn't matter what age you are, that vaccine is going to get us out of this because...
Sorry, anti-vaxxers.
If you're an, I'm willing to bet that if you're an anti-vax, you probably don't enjoy this show. That vaccine will bring the risk down to lower than the baseline levels of flu that we've had for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So if you were anxious and paranoid about flu in 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, you can continue to be. But if you weren't then, you won't in future. And it's the vaccine that's going to get us out of this.
Yeah.
So that's the key. So then you'll be able to play golf and spend hours in the clubhouse.
And see your grandchildren.
So all those reasons.
And your kids, yeah.
Play the rugby match, have the drinks in the clubhouse after the game. That's the incentive that I think we've got to work towards.
Get the shot. Good message, Ross, and thanks very much for that. And for all of you listening, good luck for the rest of the week. We'll be hopefully coming to you far more regularly over the next couple of months. We've got a plan in place to hopefully publish at least every week, maybe every second week if we really push for time. And a big thank you again to all of our Patreon supporters who supported us over the last week and those that continue to support us. But from us for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.